for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Most of us believe if we create long and complex passwords, our online accounts will be safe from hackers. But many security experts say that's just not true. And moreover, that the age of passwords is over. Joining me to talk about the illusion of online security and how to make your accounts harder to crack, Simon Davies of Privacy International and Cecilia Kang of The Washington Post. Joining us from Las Vegas Public Radio, Kevin Mitnick of Mitnick Security Consulting. I'm sure many of you will want to join in. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Cecilia Kang, if I could start with you, do you believe the assertion made on the cover of Wired magazine this month that the age of passwords is over?
I sort of do.
You do.
Age of dumb passwords has long been over. The age of just a password for security is probably over. And what we've seen is that there needs to be more layers of security online. And some companies are grappling with this and dealing with this with new and additional layers, more layers of authentication. So just the password alone is not going to do it to secure your information online.
Simon Davies, how about you?
I tend to be a little more optimistic because I think the internet will always find its way through because there's a strong commerce thread. That means that so long as people don't lose faith in the internet, there will be continuing investment in finding better security. But I agree with what Celia said because most people don't resonate with words and numbers. Word-number combinations are completely alien to our language. So the idea that we can start investing in not passwords but tokens, pictures, photographs, film, that's the sort of people resonate with that, and they'll remember that stuff because it's embedded mnemonically in their brain.
Interesting. What about you, Kevin? How do you see it?
Well, I think passwords are okay if you're like protecting access to reading the New York Times or something that's really innocuous and not sensitive. But if there's a sophisticated adversary that wants to get into your information or into your accounts, they normally can do it. It's just really too easy. And I really think we need to move towards stronger forms of authentication, like for online banking or anything to do with accessing or interacting with any type of sensitive information.
So is it true that we're seeing an increase in online security breaches, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, we read about it every day. I mean, you hear about all the antics of Anonymous and Lulzsec. And what we see nowadays is there's like a new form of hacktivism where hackers are breaking into company networks and they're getting access to their passwords that are stored in back-end databases, and they're basically dumping this out for the world to see. And what we notice from there is not only, you know, are these companies breached, but there's a lot of indications of password reuse. So if a large entity is compromised and customer passwords are dumped for all to see, it is highly likely that those victims whose passwords were dumped will use those same passwords on other sites on the internet.
Why don't complex passwords work anymore, Kevin?
Well, if, for example, like I just mentioned, if a hacker gets into a company, dumps out the passwords, and those complex passwords are there for users, you know, for anyone to see, and then they could reuse those. But complex passwords, you know, over 20 characters that are a mixture of symbols and numbers and uppercase and lowercase letters actually work to a degree. I mean, you could have a secure password, but there's always a way to attack the system. One way is just asking the user. And there was this conference out in London called the Info Security Conference. And I believe they went out to London's Waterloo Station armed with free pens. And what they would do is they would ask passersby for their password in exchange for a free pen. So you'd figure, you know, nobody's going to do it, right? But you know what? 9 out of 10. Oh. 9 out of 10 people simply gave up the password simply by asking for it. So you have that. And then you look on, you know, and then you contrast it to something more sophisticated, like sophisticated phishing attacks. And what phishing is where an attacker will send you an email purportedly from, you know, some business that you do or some company that you do business with over the internet, and they'll send you a hyperlink that looks legitimate, and you'll click it, and it goes to a fake site, and it allows hackers to trick you into inputting your credentials into a form. And then you have malware. So you basically, you have the spectrum from simply just asking the user for it all the way to more sophisticated attacks, and it doesn't matter if you choose a complex password or simple password, because the attacker is going to get it.
Cecilia.
Well, you know, it's what's interesting is we tend to have sort of contradictory views towards security. We say we want security on the one hand, but we don't want to give up convenience and privacy. And I wanted to mention, and it's interesting, this example that's mentioned, Kevin, about giving away your password for a pencil. It's amazing. The top passwords, the most common passwords released by a password management company this year called Splash, would really surprise you. They're so incredibly common. The most common passwords are password, the word itself, 12345, QWERTY, the keyboard, QWERTY, ABC123, the word monkey, the word let me in. I mean, those are the top passwords. It's so easy in a way because people would like to trade the security, the level of complexity of remembering that very complicated 20 character password for the convenience of not simply having to write it down and stash that piece of paper someplace. And you see countless examples of how celebrities, the royals with News International, their phones were hacked, voicemail systems were hacked, computers were hacked, because often people have the most simple passwords, and over for years this has been an issue.
Simon.
So this what Cecilia was talking about earlier is what we call cognitive dyspraxia in the information age, which effectively is this. Cognitive dyspraxia is where you hold an idea in your mind, like, I don't trust the internet, I believe in security, I believe in privacy, but you react in a completely different way. With passwords, it's exactly this. According to, I think I've seen 3 surveys now on password utilization, between 60 and 65% of people try to use the same password for every account they've got. And they, as Cecilia says, they make it as simple as possible. Now, what some companies have done in response is to try and force a different sort of genetic response. So what they say is you've got to have a capital letter. You've got to have at least 3 numbers, and the numbers cannot be sequential. Now, this is fine, except the human mind cannot cope with this. So people write, they write this down on notebooks, for example, and so all of their passwords are written on a notebook somewhere, and you still find a pattern in all of their passwords, which is, you can guess it. You can guess it. You
know? So it's pretty easy to break into, Kevin.
Oh, yeah, well, just the patterns, I mean, companies hire me to actually break into their network. So I do this all the time. And once I'm able to get certain rights over the network and go through this process and get to the plain text passwords, I notice that even the administrators, people that are tasked with securing the network for the business, actually always have a pattern of choosing their passwords. So, like, you know, maybe that's their favorite team, you know, their favorite sports team, you know, the Lakers. And then they'll put, like, you know, the month after that. So, like, Lakers 12. And then in January, it's going to be Lakers 01. And in August, it's going to be Lakers 08. You see the pattern? Their favorite team and then the month. And I see this time and time again. So even today, if these individuals didn't change their habits, I could predict their password today, because people love choosing, using patterns. And it's easy to remember, because people can't remember umpteen passwords, right? So what they're going to do is, you know, for each site, if they're going to go through the trouble and try to make that password unique for each different website out there on the internet, they're obviously going to choose a pattern. So now, as an attacker, looking for the attacker's viewpoint, I'm going to try to determine that person's pattern. How can you do it? If you can compromise just one site that that individual access, then
you've
what you could do is you could
thing.
You get the pattern.
Yeah.
And then you could use that intelligence to break into everything else that they have access
and
to.
And presumably, if I check out someone's Facebook page and the Facebook's, I'm a Yankees fan, I am a diehard Yankee, you can bet Yankee's going to be in their password.
And guessing is, like, in today's world, all the internet sites out there, they should have that after X amount of password attempts, that it should lock the user out for a certain amount of time. And if there's internet properties that don't do that, then it gives the attacker the advantage to simply, you know, run a complete English dictionary against that person's password and simply guess it that way.
How long ago did passwords become sort of obsolete?
Well, obsolete, you know, because so many companies and so many services just rely on a single password still. So they're still very much alive. But really, in terms of it becoming a very porous, easy security mechanism to breach, it's been years. And I think over the last few years, you've seen big examples of banks, of government agencies being hacked into. The problem is not just the fear of your data being exposed and the feeling of invasion of privacy. There's a real money bottom line problem with this as well.
Cecilia Kang, she's technology reporter for The Washington Post. We'll take a short break here. I know many of you have questions. We'll try to get to you as quickly as we can. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about the use of passwords, how, in fact, they have reached a point where, as we currently use them, they've become somewhat obsolete. In fact, Simon Davies is saying what you've got to do is to create something else. Simon, describe that something else.
Well, if you imagine that your account online is like your home, and you have a front door, and the front door, the key to the front door, or the lock, is the password. Now, you're in control of what that key and what that lock is like. I mean, you can make it a simple latch key, which means anybody with a pen can come along and just lift it from the outside. Or you can fashion it into your own design, something only you would know. Now, I mentioned before the word mnemonics. Mnemonics is basically the connection between images, stories, words, and numbers in your mind. Could people think in terms of narrative? They think in terms of stories. Now, I can remember a 25 number string just by creating a storyline around images that I've already connected with each of the 10 digits. So it might be something stupid, like two golfers are sitting on a hill and talking to God, and they saw three churches on a mound. But I remember that story. Now, all you need to do is teach kids about mnemonics. It's a short lesson at school, and they will remember any password. And it's a tremendous mental exercise. But this is why I'm worried about the premise here. When we say the age of the password is dead, I agree. The age of the secure password is dying rapidly. But the problem is we're never going to have the sort of security that we need for the internet.
Well, and the point I want to bring up with Kevin is, as one of the most famous hackers in the world, Kevin, is there any password that you could not get through?
Well, by guessing, yes. I mean, by simply trying to guess the password, but there's so many different ways
there
to break
clues.
Into... Well, there's so many different ways. If I could load malicious software onto your computer, no matter how complex your password is, I'm going to be able to obtain it.
Right.
But what people can do out there is, you know, what Simon said about, you know, which I agree to, because that's how mentalists are able to, you know, have these astounding feats of memorization, is by associating it with a story.
Sure.
But why should a individual, you know, have to go through that trouble when for free you could download these password managers out there? One of them is called KeePass. Another one is called PasswordSafe. These are absolutely free for anybody to download. And what they allow you to do is you could have them randomly. You could have this tool, the software tool, randomly generate a password for each website or each application that you need access to, and then you have to set a master password, something that's that maybe goes along with what Simon was saying, something complex that goes with some sort of story, and you basically unlock this password safe with this master password, and it allows you to completely manage all the passwords that you use. They're randomly generated, and what's really cool about it is it allows you to use a different password for each different website or application out there. So it makes it so the user doesn't have the problem of having to choose the password and manage it. There's already tools out there that allow you to do it. Of course, there's also cons to that. If malware gets onto a user's computer, no matter, you know, they could possibly put on a keylogger. And what a keylogger does is it secretly sits in the background, and when you're typing in characters, you know, on your keyboard, it steals those and sends it to the attacker. Then if they could unlock your master password database, then they have access to everything. So there's always pros and cons to how you're going to deal with the problem.
Cecilia.
Well, there's certainly many technological solutions in the works. The one thing, though, that is tried and true is that a lot of the hacking that's done, a lot of the breaches are done through what's called social engineering, just simply figuring you out. You know, I can just, if you will, Google or Bing you, you know, Diane, and figure out a lot about you through what's available on court public documents, government documents, as what's available, what you might have said one day. You know, you're on Twitter as well, so I might look at, you know, something you might have said that has some sort of personal reveal that you might have said on Twitter or Facebook or what have you. We are so exposed online right now, and that's one of the wonderful things about being online, is that you can actually be so present online. But that's the other part of it. You are so present online, and so you're very revealed, and it's very easy to figure you out.
Here's an email from Steve who says, why not use one very good password for many sites? Simon.
It would need to be very good, and I would reflect what Kevin was saying earlier, that if you're going to do that, then use one of these password managers, because people now have dozens of accounts requiring dozens of passwords. There is another. This is the elephant in the room. Let's talk about this one for a second. There is an argument that the bigger the machine gets, the internet machine, the more we have to become fused with it to have security. It's almost like an organic, a biological thing. So the fusion of flesh and machine would mean there is a biometric solution, in other words, fingerprints. Now, I hate the idea of fingerprinting and biometrics and iris scans when it comes to government, for example, or corporations. But there are ways, and Kevin, you're probably right on the cutting edge of this, there are ways that you can securely use a biometric, a fingerprint, from your machine, where there is, a handshake with a website that recognizes that biometric. Now, it's not given to anybody else. It's not disclosed. It's encrypted securely. Now, that is a possibility.
Is that where we're headed?
Well, I say if it works. I was going to ask Kevin, does the biometric solution actually work?
Well, let me tell you a quick story. I was hired by a company that was working on a financial company, a financial services company, and they were pretty much a target-rich environment because if their site was compromised, it gives the attacker access to cash. And so they were looking at security solutions, and one of them was a voice biometric security solution. So they tasked me with testing the security. And basically what you would do to register is you'd have to repeat a series of digits a few times, and then it would tell you what digits to say. It'd say, you know, please say 52167. You say 52167, and it'd have you go through the process. You'd register. And then when you had to verify who you were to authenticate, it would ask you, you know, please say a series of numbers, and you'd say it. And if it recognized your voice, it authenticated you. So they said, is this secure? So what I ended up doing is contacted the CEO of the company, asked if I could, you know, try to test the system for security flaws. He said fine. And then a couple days later, I gave the I called up the CEO, and I used a thing called caller ID spoofing, which allowed me to change the number that would be displayed on his phone. And what number I set to display on his phone was 702-354-1689. And that's just what those digits are. It's actually 1 through 0. And so what I did is when I called him, I said, oh, by the way, did you get my new phone number? And he goes, oh, yeah, it's on my caller ID. Oh, which one do you have? And he actually goes, oh, 702-354-1689. Oh, yeah, you're right. That's the number to reach me on in the future, which, you know, wasn't true. But now I was able to take a recording of his voice saying the digits and break it out into a digit, each digit at a time. Goodness. So then I was able to call into the system and with his voice break through the system.
Whoa.
And it took all about 10 minutes. So there you go. There's always a way to get around the system.
Okay, so that's a voice metric. But what about some kind of iris scan or fingerprint?
Well, once somebody steals your biometric, it depends how it's, you know, it's gone forever. Depends how it's implemented. If they do an iris scan and it sends a blob of data to a server, and the attacker could intercept that blob of data, it really depends on the implementation. Yeah. Then they could just replay the data, for example, depending on how this system was implemented. You know, we're talking about, you know, simplistic stuff here. So if the hacker could replay your biometric authentication, well, then they could impersonate you.
Yeah, this is a problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, with iris scans, for example, I mean, people think it's fancy technology. It's not. It's a snap. That's all it is, and it takes your eye. It puts into a string of numbers, puts the string of numbers down the line, and that authenticates you. The fingerprints could be a bit tougher, though. I don't know if you agree with this, Cecilia. I think the fingerprints take a lot. To steal someone's fingerprint and actually convert it electronically into a way that could be used live, online, maybe that's getting a bit
difficult.
That's
already been compromised. A Japanese guy used gummy bears.
Oh, yeah, but he had to use gelatin, and it was...
He used gummy bears?
Yes, he did.
He used gummy bears. Let's not miss that point. It's very interesting.
He used gummy bears to compromise.
That's amazing. Well, I've also heard, and I'd be interested to hear, Kevin, from you and Simon, that printing has become so sophisticated with HD printing, 3D printing coming as well, that you can essentially replicate fingerprints and iris, you know, identification going forward.
You guys are leaving me with
the bottom line is,
I mean, really?
What, there's always a way around the system, depending on
that's
the
what
attacker.
You're saying. Yeah. And here's an email from Ralph who says, how does malware get into a computer and how does it work? Cecilia.
Well, Kevin's actually really the pro on this. Well, there's many ways malware can get into the computer, and I think it's become much easier when we're connected onto the internet all the time. So once you're inside your device through the cloud, Wi-Fi networks are particularly vulnerable as well. Then you attack the computer, and you get whatever information you want. And Kevin, please correct me. Jump in.
Well, if he can get his email address, I'll send him a PDF file and demonstrate it to him. No, I'm just kidding. But usually it's by opening up Office documents or PDF files that have been booby-trapped. And the reason that works is because the software that resides on the individual's desktop is vulnerable and probably not updated. Or clicking on a hyperlink that exploits a vulnerability in the browser that the person is using. So one method to try to remediate this is people out there can go and download a program that's actually free of charge called Personal Software Inspector. And what this does is it actually scans your system, your desktop, tries to find what software is out of date, and it notifies you so you can update that software so you don't remain vulnerable. But that's how attackers break in, is they send you through email, usually, a booby trap file, a booby trap hyperlink, and when you click on it or open up that attachment, the game is over, they're in, and you're out.
All right, so now tell me about the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Justice, all the government email accounts. Kevin, how do you get in?
How does the CIA get in, or how does someone get into the CIA?
How would you get in to the CIA?
Well, to be honest with you, it probably wouldn't be that hard. And all you really have to do is, a government agency like the CIA has a lot of employees. And if you could do what we call information reconnaissance and try to determine what software that an individual is using on their desktop and the version, like if they're using, for example, an older version of Adobe Acrobat, for as an example. And then really all you have to do is try to determine who that person would likely have contact with, what companies, what other government agencies, what individuals. You could usually find that through social networking. And then what you do is you send that person an email with a booby trap file that, as soon as they open up the file, it exploits, again, a vulnerability in the software that resides on their desktop. And now the attacker is inside the system. And this is exactly what happened at RSA, which is a large security company. One employee opened up an Excel document that was booby-trapped, and RSA ended up losing extremely sensitive information. It happened to Google. It happened to several DOD government agencies. This is a hybrid of social engineering. You're using social engineering, which is using manipulation, deception, and influence to get a target to comply with a request, and that is to open up a file, right, or click on a hyperlink. And then once they do that, it exploits a technical vulnerability in the software that resides on the desktop. So
Kevin,
this is how you would compromise a government agency.
Kevin Mitnick, he's an information security expert, a former hacker. His latest book is titled Ghost in the Wires, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. It sounds to me as though you are all saying, number one, be careful of what you open. When you don't know something or from where that individual email or something is coming from. But as far as passwords are concerned, it sounds to me as though you're saying anybody can get into your account at any time. Son.
I think what we're all saying in a way is, yes, the passwords are becoming more vulnerable, simply because the weight of the attack and the potential attack on you is greater and greater. But remember, that's only because people don't understand the risk. People are going to go just opening whatever, as you say, they'll use the same passwords. They don't understand, because it's been so, I mean, human history, this is such a recent development. It's going to be another two generations before people get security, and they understand, and people will adapt accordingly. This is why I know I got quite pessimistic right a bit toward the end there, but I do keep my optimism that ultimately we and people, the internet as an organism, will adapt. And the one line we absolutely have to draw, though, is the privacy line. There's too much information being demanded. I mean, you see it in the real world. I was out last night in D.C., people demanding identification. I'm a middle-aged man. Identification to go into a bar. You can imagine what it's like in the online world. People will just... And everybody was giving their IDs to this bouncer.
Yeah.
And I was saying to them, what are you doing? Why are you giving your identity? These people want your money for a drink. Now, it's the same online. Information is demanded of you by all these sites in the name of security, and people will just hand it over without question. Now, that's got to stop, and that will stop.
Scott McNeely says, you have no privacy, get over it.
Yes, I remember that.
Cecilia.
I would actually say that people do, to a certain extent, understand the risks. They're just not willing to to give up the convenience of a free email provider, a free documents cloud service, a free social networking site. They're not willing to give up sort of the convenience of that, of using these services for the sake of privacy.
But
I mean, of
look
security.
Ahead two generations, as Simon has just done. Do you believe that somehow within two generations we will have figured out a new way to have privacy?
Well, definitely there's two
secure
competing.
Privacy.
There's definitely going to be better security. There's great security already out there, as Kevin mentioned. Password managers are really simple solutions. There is, but you have competing forces. You have technology that's changing, that's becoming much easier to hack into, making it easier to hack into systems, as well as better security technology.
Cecilia Kang, technology reporter for The Washington Post. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com, and by the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Well, the next Fresh Air, where does economic development end and corporate welfare begin? We talk with New York Times reporter Louise Story about her investigative series, United States of Subsidies, about how big corporations are demanding tax breaks from the cities and states they locate in, creating a gigantic bill for taxpayers. Join us.
And here's an email from Nate in Baltimore. What about double authentication as Google offers for its accounts? How secure is that process? Kevin.
Well, I'm actually, I love Google's two-step authentication. In fact, when it first came out, I tweeted to all my followers that they should immediately enable it. And what Google allows you to do is you could set up the service, the security service. So when you log into your account, not only do you need your password, but you need a 6-digit code. And this code changes every time you log in. And if you're using an Android or an iPhone, you could download this application onto your phone and it will display the code, or you could choose to have the code sent to you by text message or actually to call you and verbally give you the code. And I think that if you're a Gmail user or you're using Facebook or Dropbox or any of these services, you should immediately activate two-step authentication, what we call two-factor authentication. And has this been compromised? Well, if people set up on their email account a phone number, and the phone number allows you to do a password reset, if attackers could compromise your cellular phone account at AT&T, T-Mobile, or whatever, and usually they can by simply just finding out the last four digits of your social security number. Then what they could do is they could do what we call an account takeover. What they'll do is they'll first compromise your cellular phone account, forward your number to their prepaid cell phone or a pay phone or whatever. Then they'll go through the password reset process. And when Google calls your phone to do the password reset, it actually gets transferred to the attacker's phone. And they go through the process and they hijack your account.
All right, so, Simon, you've had some experience with this.
This is a real world sort of, as opposed to the cyber world. This is a real world double authentication. Listeners will have this experience where your providers, your cell phone provider, your bank, whatever, will ring you periodically. And how do you know it's them on the other end of the line? They ask you for authentication. Would you give us your zip code and date of birth? Well, who am I giving this to?
Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
know. So with all of my providers, I've told them on the special instruction field on the account, and everyone can do this, it's a good fun game for everyone to play, there is a special instruction field. You give them a word to put into that field, and then when they call you, you say, go to the scroll down, special instruction field, what's the word there? And they'll say poopsie poo or something ridiculous like that, you know. Something that will make the whole call centre giggle, you know. And I then know there's no more arguments about this. I don't have to call them back at my expense. You know, I know who they are. They know who I am.
And Cecilia, what about you? How do you use double authentication?
Well, I'm a fan of the double authentication as well. I've done that with my Google accounts and my other accounts as well. The idea is, and you see this actually also with credit cards, you know, the security card in the back of your card. So the idea is that your credit card might be all over the internet, your credit card number, but you have in your hand your credit card and only you can see the back security code. I mean, that's the idea, at least.
But you have to put that security code up there as well.
So that sort of defeats the idea, is that the idea of double authentication or even multiple authentication is that you have multiple ways of saying this is really you. I'm carrying my phone on me, so only I will see that text message with that security code that I enter into relog onto my Gmail, for
All
example.
Right. Here is a caller in Bradenton, Florida. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Diane. Good to speak to you.
Thank you.
I feel in a way this has almost been answered, but you know, we hear a lot about encryption technology, which even the US government can't always decipher. And I wondered whether a password was created with letters, numbers, symbols, or was biometric, whether it couldn't in some way be encrypted so that, it would be very difficult to break it.
Simon.
I'll defer to Kevin on this one because he knows the cutting edge on the encrypted passwords. But it's as he will probably say, it's not quite the solution that it's made out to.
All right, Kevin.
Well, actually, in Windows, your password is, you know, what we call hashed. And which is, you know, a form of encryption, let's say. And there's tools out there to basically do dictionary attacks and to run it through what we call rainbow tables, which are already pre-computed passwords. So that idea really won't work. But I want to digress, Diana, when we're talking about when Simon was talking about his authentication at his financial institution, I recently called Bank of America because I had an issue with my credit card, and they go, "Hi, what's your name?" I go, "You know, Kevin Mitnick," and they go, "Okay, sir, what's your password?" I go, "Okay, I'm thinking because I'm trying to remember what password I set for this account." They said, "Oh, no problem, sir. We'll help you out. It's a place you'd like to vacation, and it begins with an H." And then I wanted to ask the lady. I said, "Can I?" I wanted to say, "Could I buy a vowel?" I wanted to buy a vowel. You know, and this is customer service today, where you know it's all about convenience and customer service, and security is the lowest on the totem pole here.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to tell you that funny story.
Okay, let's go to Middletown, Maryland. Good morning, Stan.
Good morning. I just want to talk about the password issue. So I read a security report that said the password should be longer than 14, should at least be 14 letters. And so the way I solve it is I have two address books that I keep to sites that I go to written down, and I bought a Rubik's Cube. And on the Rubik's Cube, I assigned numbers, letters, uppercase, lowercase, and symbols randomly. And all I have to do to generate a 16-code password is to just twist the cube a few times.
That's
awesome. How do you like that? How do you like that, Kevin?
That's awesome. I'd use a password manager, you know, instead of going through that trouble.
Yeah, passwords can still be hacked. So I don't keep anything related to passwords on the computer anywhere.
And you know another problem, Diane, is when I'm doing security testing at companies and I get into their file servers, the first thing I do is do a full directory looking for any files that are password, passwords.doc, .xls, .csv. And in 100% of the cases, I find that my clients' users are actually storing plain text passwords in Excel documents, in text documents, and it basically is the keys to the kingdom.
I'm breathless. I really am. My producer, Susan Neighbors, says she's going to move to the woods. Go ahead, son.
I was going to say, though, we look at the internet and we imagine it as a technology network. It's actually not. It's increasingly a social network, and it conforms to social norms and mores. And no social system has ever been perfect. There's always been security threats, whether it's, you know, chasing animals for food or, you know, security within a town. And maybe we don't want 100% security because God knows what cost that would apply in terms of our freedoms. So I like this tension. I love the fact that here we are, 2012, having this debate with people engaged, and we're sort of generally optimistic, and we're aware of the threats. I mean, that wasn't the case 10 years ago. You know, so things are moving forward, and like any social system, we will adapt and improve, as I said before.
I hope you're right. Let's go now to Burlington, Kentucky. Good morning, Andy.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I'm a contractor for AT&T, and talking about the issue of biometrics for use in security earlier, I was reading on AT&T's website about a technology that they're developing that they're calling bioacoustical data transfer that, from what I can understand, sends a small little pulse through the user's skeletal frame from a device such as a watch or a smartphone, and everybody's skeletal frame has like a unique harmonic, and then they can use that to establish identity. So I just wanted to know if any of your panelists familiar with that or might be able to shed some light on it, because I'm feeling that's kind of Star Trek-ish a little bit.
Yeah, it sounds that way. What about that, Kevin?
Yeah.
Bioacoustical data.
Yeah, I haven't heard of such a thing, but it did give me a chuckle.
So what do you think, son?
Biometrics, obviously, because there's so much money going into research at the moment. In the European Union, I noticed that they were pumping some money into body odor biometrics. So, you know, it would basically take sort of pheromone or whatever that was unique.
How about my perfume?
Have you got pheromones in your perfume?
Oh, exactly, exactly.
See, it would pick that up, but I'm guessing that what they're looking for is the unique, that unique combination.
Sure.
And so nothing surprises me in the biometric arena anymore.
All right, let's go to Kyle in Wixom, Michigan. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, Kevin. Big fan. So, I'd just like to say that I'm a developer for CRM systems, and I administer over them. And one of the biggest security compromises that I've seen is actually the email system itself. The email system is kind of the keys to the castle. If you can get the password to the email, you can go to other services and click on the reset my password button, and it will just be emailed to you or a quick way to get into the system. So,
Well, hopefully it does a password reset and doesn't send you the plain text password. That's kind of scary. Most sites will send you the reset, so the victim will eventually figure out they can't get into their account and realize that there's a problem.
Right. It's not the best way to get in, but it certainly does happen, and people can get in pretty easily, actually. You can... there's services in China and whatnot that will send you a corporate email account for about $100. So I just wanted to give my comment, and I'll pick everything else up here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Anything else?
By the way, what he did say is about breaking into a corporate email account for $100, there's a service
that you could send $100 to these guys, and what they would do is they would guarantee they would break in to a person's Yahoo account, Hotmail, Gmail, it didn't even matter, and they would charge you $100 that you'd have to send. So I actually wanted to figure out what they were doing. So I set up a fake email account for me. I sent the $100 and I said, hey, go ahead and crack this person's account. It's my girlfriend's account, when it was just an account I set up. And so what it ended up being at the end of the day is they sent a phishing email. And a phishing email is basically an email that contained a hyperlink that once you click it, it looked like you were logging back onto your email service. So it was a very simple type of attack, yet effective, because these guys were making money.
Yeah, and that's the question I have, Cecilia. Who is it that's hacking into our accounts? Who wants them?
So what's interesting, on the one hand, you have organized crime organizations outside of the U.S. that want information that's very valuable, that can get into your bank accounts, actually take money, for example, in the U.S. as well. Then you often have, in this Wired article, and we heard this anecdotally as well, just bored people who do this sort of for fun. They wanted the challenge of seeing if they can hack into something. So, and then you also have groups that are sort of semi-anarchic, you know, and groups like Anonymous, who do this with a purpose. You know, if they feel like, for example, the FBI made a bad decision on something, they'll take down the FBI site. So there's lots of different groups that try to hack for different motivations, but there's money, there's sometimes boredom, there's sometimes also the thrill and the challenge.
Ah, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kevin, give us a sense of some of the new techniques that people are working on to try to protect passwords.
Well, they're moving to more forms of authentication, not just relying on a single factor such as a password, going to multiple factor authentication, and then using technologies where you could authenticate to, for example, maybe a business website by through your Facebook account, or basically by, if you log into your Facebook account, it uses this process to authenticate you to a third-party company. So this is becoming more popular. And there's companies out there that are developing new technologies and trying to come up with better ways to authenticate the end user, because it is such a big hole in the system, and to help companies and businesses and people protect themselves in a better way.
All right. Final caller in Cleveland, Ohio. Shoghi, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me there. Big fan. I wanted to know if there's a difference for the consumers. Your experts can comment on Windows versus Apple machines. A lot of people buy Apple products. I've been a big fan for the last few years after working in PCs for a while. And if the security and password management on their browsers is any different.
Simon.
I'm not familiar with it. Well, I'm an Apple user, and I'm becoming a little bit distressed, frankly, at some of the changes in their design, I've got to say. So, I mean, I'd again defer to Cecilia and Kevin on this one. I've got to say that the Microsoft, from what I can see, is shifting security and privacy significantly in the right direction. I mean, the problem Apple generally, as I see, is what you might call the magnetic ports problem. It's little things. Design problems with Microsoft, Apple are starting to become obvious, and I'm wondering whether Apple's kind of losing its grip on a lot of design elements, whereas Microsoft, as a kind of operating system, seems to be getting its head wrapped around security and privacy.
All right.
I don't know. You two may have a different
Kevin.
View on this.
Well, you know, people ask me that question all the time. What's more secure, having Apple or Apple? Apple or Windows. And I think actually Windows is a more secure operating system if you actually, you know, have it configured and hardened properly. But what the problem is you have a lot of virus or what we call malware writers out there, and they develop malicious code to attack the populace. And Microsoft still has the greater market share. So if you have the Russian business network that wants to compromise, you know, as many people as they can, they're going to write a piece of malware for the Windows operating system and deploy that into the wild. And So that's why we don't see a lot of problems with people that are using, you know, the Mac platforms, is because they're not being as attacked as much as people using the Windows platform. But I think that is going to change. Now we're seeing people shift to attacking Mac platforms as well.
Cecilia.
You know, I have a question actually for Kevin. And if does that also very apply quickly to smartphones? Because I feel like smartphones, everything is connected. Your contact lists and everything are so connected with different third
sure
parties.
Kevin,
well,
very quickly.
Well, the Android platform, for example, is, you know, there's been lots of exploits for that. If people jailbreak their iPhone, it kind of opens them up to exploitation. So these, you know, the iPhone runs pretty much an operating, it's running, these devices run an operating system, and they could be attacked just like a computer can. And you're right, it's a very target-rich environment.
Well, I have to leave it there. Kevin Mitnick, Cecilia Kang, Simon Davies, you've given us all tons to think about. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ring.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.